Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. This show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Busy week this week, friends, cinematically and otherwise. Snowmageddon was supposed to happen, and it didn't. I wound up staying home, catching up on the pile of movies that have been sent to me. We'll get to that in a little bit. Going to dip into the archives this week, thanks to Fresh Air for the inspiration on that, as well as the Academy Award nominations, which came out this week. Yes, the Film Geeks Final Four has happened. And so we'll break that down in just a second, and a couple of new films that have really good timing with the Academy Awards. All right. Here are your 10 Best Picture nominees, because everybody has to be nominated. All Quiet on the Western Front, Avatar, Banshees of Inisherin, Elvis, Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Fabelmans, Tar, Top Gun Maverick, Triangle of Sadness, and Women Talking. If we were a grown-up, what would my five be? Would be Banshees of Inisherin, Everything Everywhere All at Once, Women Talking, Tar, and The Fabelmans, I guess. Yeah. Obviously, it doesn't reflect my five, except for Everything Everywhere All at Once, which was my top film of last year. And Banshees of Inisherin, top five. All right. And I pardon the names if I butcher them. Best actor in a leading role, Austin Butler for Elvis, Colin Farrell for Banshees of Inisherin, Brendan Fraser in The Whale, Paul Mescal in After Sun, and Bill Nye for Living, which we're going to talk about in just a little bit. Best actress in a leading role, Cate Blanchett for Tar, Ana de Armas for Blonde, Andrea Riseborough into Leslie, if folks are talking about the campaign on that one, Michelle Williams for The Fabelmans, Michelle Yeoh for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, supporting actor, Brendan Gleeson, Banshees of Inisherin, Brian Tyree Henry in Causeway, Judd Hirsch in The Fabelmans, Barry Keoghan in Banshees of Inisherin, and Ke Huy Quan, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. And in Best Supporting Actress, Angela Bassett, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, Hong Chau, The Whale, Kerry Condon, Banshees of Inisherin, Jamie Lee Curtis, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, Stephanie Hsu, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. So, no female directors. So apparently we got a ways to go. Like Sarah Polley, at the very least, because that Women Talking made my top 10. Speaking of which, Women Talking opened in Indianapolis this weekend. Great timing there. I know Everything Everywhere All at Once is getting a re-release. The documentary of All the Beauty and the Bloodshed has opened in town this weekend as well as Living, which made my top five. So, I was, as I said before, the first week in January, when I do my top 10 list, I tried to do it as late as possible because I'm still getting through films. There's still some films that were nominated I haven't gotten to, so that's what we'll do here. By the way, you can hear a longer breakdown of the top 10 of Three Gentlemen of the IFJA in the Medium Cool podcast, so go look for that with Joe and Austin. Living opens this week with Bill Nighy is getting a career great performance. And this is a guy, you know, most American audiences have first got to notice him from Love Actually, and he has been a consistently fine working that guy ever since. and this is his first nomination, and I'm really excited about this. First off, it's a remake of Ikuru, the great Kurosawa drama. Bill plays a civil servant, you know, devoted to his job for decades. He is a widower, but does his job efficiently, everything to the letter, in order, and then he finds out he has an incurable, he's going to die within a matter of months. And he decides to live, not in the wacky Hollywood way, not in the bucket list kind of way, but in a subtle, refined way, even if it's going out drinking with a friend he had just met on the coast, doesn't tell anybody where he's going, and starts to loosen his tie, or, you know, loosen up as much as he can. And there he winds up meeting a young lady played by Amy Lou Wood, and it doesn't quite go that way, but there is a subplot involving the young lady and a young man that works under the Williams character, the Bill Nighy character. I'm a big Kurosawa fan, and if you don't know Ikuru, it's one of probably his greatest non-action film. And beautifully told, really fine, because the other film nomination this got was for adaptation, so Kazuo Ishiguro, congratulations on that. A little history lesson. So by the 1950s, and you know, this played in Japan originally as Ikuru, and now here, where everybody wants everything in order. The war is over. Now we're going to get to living, and for a lot of people in the U.S., it was living in the suburbs, but you have your job and your order, and everything is in its place. And so it was happening in Japan. It was obviously happening in England. It was happening in a lot of countries. We just wanted normality. So this is one of the few examples of when I see a really good foreign film, Man Called Uwe, I'm looking at you, it doesn't have to be remade. And they remade it in the Man Called Otto. So in this case, it's a universal story, and I understand that. But the lead character is so good, and there's a moment with the Williams character where he does not give an Oscar speech. Basically, you know, talking about regrets or his past life or things like that. Instead, he does it in a song. And this is not the first time we've heard this actor sing, obviously, because we know him from Love Actually. But it is gut-wrenching to watch him with a few pints in, singing his heart out. And then there's even that moment where he's going to go down a different path and forgets the words. So it's beautifully done, beautifully told. And it's also kind of bookend and played. It is shot like a 1950s British melodrama. Which, you know, film history fans, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But it's a really lovely film. It also makes fun of the paper pushing process that happens, where you have to go to a lot of places and fill out a lot of forms, and not everything gets done. And for the Williams character, he wants to get something done. Doesn't have to have his name on it. Doesn't have to have it, you know, honored in his memory. But he gets something done. And so, not to really give away a whole lot, but the famous image in Ikuru is a gentleman on a swing, and we get a version of that here. So, and I remember, I need to revisit Ikuru because now I'm in my 50s. I remember seeing it in my 20s and was kind of blown away by it, and I'm sure it will resonate even more. So, congratulations to Living for its two nominations. Please go see this film in the theater. It's got good timing, like I said, when it comes to getting the nominations, and will hopefully get a bigger audience. As will Women Talking, which is the film from written, adapted for the screen, and directed by Sarah Polley, where set in a religious community where the women in this community decide to discuss the fact that they have been victims of sexual assault, not only by the local townies, but in their own community. And the discussion is do nothing, stay or fight. Now, many years ago, my lovely kid, when I was directing the play Born Yesterday, had created the new genre Men in Suits Talking. So the fact that we have a film called Women Talking cracks me up. But There is a lot of action in the talking in this. We kind of during the Medium Cool podcast, somebody brought up, it's kind of like this is their version of 12 Angry Men. It also helps that you have Rooney Mara, Claire Foy, Frances McDormand, Judith Ivey, Jesse Buckley, all involved. Ben Whishaw's your token male. And the very riveting, electric discussions that come from these women and what needs to be done. So this is another one that's also benefiting. It's got a couple nominations. As I said, one for Best Picture, as well as Sarah Polley for Best Adapted Screenplay. So that is out in theaters as well. As I mentioned, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, which follows the career of Nan Goldin, and not only her work as an artist, but also trying to take down the Sackler family and the opioid crisis. This is the organization that put a lot of money into museums and to art establishments, even though they were part of the problem. So that's another one that's up for Best Documentary and is opening this week. So go check those out. Congratulations on the nomination. And, of course, this is the thing. I think more eyes are going to go on Banshees of Inisherin. Hopefully more people are checking out Everything Everywhere All at Once, Women Talking, All Quiet on the Western Front. I'm kind of stunned that Triangle of Sadness got in there. I didn't like it as much as, say, The Square, but it's in there. So anyway, go check those out. And not when are the Oscars? It doesn't say here on the list, so there you go. But anyway, it'll be coming up soon. And if there is an update of my top 10, I will let you know. But yeah, congratulations to everybody there. Okay, let's go through around the horn, and I'll let you know what I've been watching on video, and then we'll get to the grab a pencil portion of the show, and then we'll dip into the archives at IU Cinema, Friday night, January 27th, 7 p.m. from 2022 is a part of the International Art House series is Utama. Friday night at 10 o'clock is a part of the Not Quite Midnight series, Possessor from 2020. Utama is going to be replayed Saturday the 28th at 4 o'clock. Saturday the 28th at 7 p.m., the 1973 film Love and Anarchy. Tuesday, January 31st at 7 p.m. from 1973, Mean Streets. Great chance to see that on the big screen. Thursday, February 2nd at 7 o'clock, the 1998 film of The X-Files. Friday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. From 2022, International Art House series, Leonore Will Never Die. And then as the Not Quite Midnight series at 10 o'clock on Friday the 3rd, Night of the Comet, for you fans of the 80s. That is over at IU Cinema. Over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin tonight, Friday and Saturday. Friday at 7:30, Saturday 2 and 7:30 p.m., The Harvey Girls from 1946. Friday and Saturday, February 10th and 11th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., is Funny Face from 1957. February 17th and 18th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., from 1987, Moonstruck. And February 24th and 25th, 2 and 7:30 p.m. from 1955, All That Heaven Allows. All of that at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. As I mentioned, All the Beauty and Bloodshed is playing at the Can-Can, as is The Whale, as is Infinity Pool and Possessor, and Women Talking. So that is happening over at the Can-Can. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Catching up on the stack of videos, the pile's getting smaller and smaller, and I thank everybody's patience on this. But probably my favorite of the lot this week was a New Zealand drama put out by Film Movement called Poppy. And Poppy is played by Libby Hunsale. Poppy is a 19-year-old girl who has Down syndrome but wants to take charge of her own life, and one of those things that she wants to do is to become an auto mechanic. She wouldn't mind racing as well. She's living at home with her brother, who is running Dad's garage. Dad is no longer with us. Brother is hit on hard times. Both parents are dead. He is trying to be responsible and irresponsible at the same time. But we see her trying to take her driver's license test, trying to get a boy in her life, trying to become a mechanic, you know, getting better at being a mechanic, trying to clean up her brother's life. There's a lot on the shoulders of young Poppy in this film. And it doesn't sugarcoat it. It doesn't condescend. We even get scenes of intimacy that we don't expect that might make some people uncomfortable. Not me. So, but yeah, it's a really nice slice of life, and a good performance from Libby Hunsdale. So look for Poppy. That's out on Film Movement. Also out from Kino Lorber. And I send this out to the Golden Globus guys. I sent them a picture of this. By the way, the Golden Globus Theater this week, Iron Eagle, the first one. They made four of those things. Next week is their Blaxploitation Appreciation Month, and they're going to start with Blackula next week. Yours truly will be a guest later in February to discuss the cult film Detroit 9000, but we'll get to that in a little bit. But I bring this up because Golden Globus Theater has white-hot hatred for Robert Ginty, and I got to see one of his films called Program to Kill, also known as The Retaliators. The star Sandahl Bergman, for you fans of Conan the Barbarian, she is a terrorist captured by ex-CIA agent Robert Ginty. She is used as an experiment and is used as an experimental brain surgery. They reprogram her, and they not only use her to go after the terrorists that she used to work for, but to find out if you could actually control your living soldiers. Paul Walker is a very young Paul Walker has a bit part playing Ginty's son. I can hear Golden Globus Theater making jokes about this. But we get to the kind of robotic acting that Bergman's character needs to do, which kind of works in this case. But what happens when your experiment short circuits and goes on a killing spree on their own? Sandahl Bergman's a very physical person. I remember there's a fight scene with her character in Ginty's, and we see several flips done in several angles, obviously done by a stunt double, but I didn't know if we, one, could have maybe not as many angles, many cuts in one particular scene. But yeah, it's kind of a, obviously a Terminator, a little bit of Eve of Destruction, a little bit of what happens when your weapons go haywire. And also the fact that you have this really long climactic shootout and Robert Ginty's family is watching from a window as opposed to hiding. So just an odd film from Kino Lorber called Program to Kill. There are not one, but two films Kino Lorber put out from the late 60s, both directed by Buzz Kulik. Now, Buzz Kulik was a guy who did a lot of TV work and then did a handful of feature films. My favorite of his being the 1973 detective story Seamus, starring Burt Reynolds and Diane Cannon. But we start with the 1967 drama Warning Shot. This stars David Janssen as a Los Angeles cop who has just recently gotten back on patrol after an incident, finds a suspect, thinks he's pulled out a gun, and shoots the guy. And when they once the crime, the police and the ambulance show up, nobody can find the gun, and Janssen's in trouble. It's interesting that this came around. This film was released in 1967, when there was unrest with the police, especially in Los Angeles, among other places. As you watch this film, it does have a made-for-TV look to it. And then I found out in research, this was deemed too mature and too violent for made-for-television, so they released it as a feature film. Well, it was 1967, friends. If anything else, the stereotypical swishy gay photo fashion shoot is more offensive than the violent actions in this film. You see a lot of familiar faces. David Janssen, Janssen did this while taking a break. This was actually in between seasons of making The Fugitive. Not taking a break. A lot of familiar faces. Keenan Wynn plays his partner. Wow, who's the old cop in this group? Their boss is played by Ed Begley Sr. Carol O'Connor, you see. Lillian Gish, Steve Allen, young Joe Collins, young Stephanie Powers, old George Sanders. So just an interesting film that was put out by Paramount. And while we had more action violent films like Bonnie and Clyde coming around the bend, this is what the studios were putting out as a major studio picture. And then a year later, there was a film put out called Sergeant Riker. This is one I've always heard about. It's with Lee Marvin and It's funny, if you look at the artwork for this, extremely deceiving. Marvin plays a sergeant who is put on trial for possibly being a traitor and selling secrets to the enemy. And it's more of a military drama than an action film. And then we found out this was a TV movie back in 1963 that they have repackaged and released in theaters because of the success of Lee Marvin in The Dirty Dozen. Now, Marvin already had an Oscar under his belt with Cat Ballou, so that was probably part of it as well. And so, yeah, Bradford Dillman's in this, Norman Fell, Murray Hamilton. Hey, Norman Fell and Murray Hamilton, it's a little graduate get-together. Peter Graves is in this as well. Another one, it looks like a TV film, and they just kind of put it out there in theaters. But, yeah, those are two from Kino Lorber, both directed by Buzz Kulik. I need to pick up. Hopefully there is a Kino Lorber treatment of Seamus with Burt Reynolds, because I'd like to hear a commentary track on that. Also out on video is a very cool film called Voodoo Macbeth, and it's the story of a 20-year-old Orson Welles who is going to put on his all-African-American production of Macbeth in 1936 with hopefully help from the Federal Theater, although there's some red tape that comes into play in this film, or in the story. The fact that there was already several productions of Macbeth going on, but not with an all-African-American cast, and instead of setting it in Scotland, they set it in the Caribbean. So we see the backstage drama of trying to get this show off the ground, some of the red tape, and the fact that we had a woman who's playing Lady Macbeth. I can say Macbeth. I'm in a recording studio. I'm not in a theater. Get over it. And how there needs to be more African Americans in the crew. So Orson Welles has to fire a few people, including his wife, who is a producer in the play, and this was her idea to begin with. We get a more in-depth look at some of the characters, including a heavyweight boxer who gets cast in the show, and a couple other characters that are dealing with their sexuality, which I don't think has actually happened, but it makes for decent storytelling in this film. And we get to see the work in progress and how Shakespeare can be done. This was a huge deal in the 1930s, having an all-African-American cast doing Shakespeare. And then we have a very busy opening night cinematically. So lots of movie event moments happening in this opening night backstage drama. So look for Voodoo Macbeth on Lightyear Entertainment. Also one from Kino Lorber from 1986. Oh, man. This is one, again, I always heard about but had never seen. The crime drama No Mercy from 1986 starring Richard Gere and Kim Basinger. You have also coming off the bench Ray Sharkey, William Atherton, George DeZunda, Terry Kinney, Bruce McGill, and Jerome Carabe, who we'll get to in a little bit. I was thinking of the Golden Globus guys. When they did Roadhouse, they did a segment on who they say are cinema tough guys that aren't really tough. And No Mercy has Richard Gere as everyone's favorite Chicago cop. He finds out through some vital information that there are some folks from New Orleans that are trying to order a hitman to come down and do a job. Gere and his partner get involved, and let's just say things go awry. Things do not go according to plan. Gere's partner is killed, and Gere wants nothing but vengeance, so he heads down to Louisiana to take matters into his own hands, even if he gets in the way and in the face of Bruce McGill, and a very young Charles Dutton gets involved. Crabby plays the killer who offs his partner. He's also the property owner of one Kim Basinger that catches Gere's eyes. Also, Terry Kinney has a brief role as her brother, which is very amusing for you Chicago stage fans out there. And then we find out Gere and Basinger wind up being handcuffed together and being chased after by all of the baddies in the greater Louisiana area. So there's a little bit of defiant ones, a lot of them shot running in the swamp, and even though they're up to their eyeballs in swamp water and alligators and killers, both of them look, Gere and Basinger, both look great. This is directed by Richard Pierce, who gave us Country as well as Heartland, a favorite of mine, and A Family Thing. And this is a film where these two have to fall in love. They're the stars. even though the characters don't particularly like each other. That's never really stopped us before. And again, no matter what the situation, they look stunning. Whether they're taking a shower together with clothes on because they're handcuffed together, whether he finally opens up about her feelings, she opens up about his, just enough to show some connection, but not enough to really accept that these two really hit it off. Although Jerome Crabbe, this was one of his first American films. It's not his first. He would later do one of the Timothy Dalton films. Worked with Paul Verhoeven, of course. Another one that kind of got him noticed in the United States was playing Barbara Streisand's husband in Prince of Tides. But there's a fun interview with him on this disc talking about how he got the role. And read interviews with Jerome Crabbe. They're really entertaining and very thorough. So that's probably the best part of this kind of glossy 80s film that's half Chicago, half New Orleans. And you can't quite believe anybody involved in that. But yeah, that's No Mercy from Kino Lorber on Blu-ray. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, we're going to grab a pencil, find out what you've been watching this week, and then we'll dip into the archives. All right? We start on Facebook with Lou Harry, who deemed Triangle of Sadness as annoying blah blahness. See, he's trying to be Gene Shalit there. And he goes, and if this counts, the Aaron Ponzer Teller version of The Tempest, music by Tom Waits, from the Roundhouse Theater. Nick chimes in, I think Ruben Östlund is largely overrated. Love Triangle of Sadness before they got on the boat. After that, every choice is obvious and boring. And Lou agrees. Doug writes, Roman Holiday, In the Heat of the Night, Rear Window, and more from 2022, Decision to Leave, Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, My Year of Dicks, Till and to Leslie. Nick Rogers writes, Great World of Sound, End of the Century, The Story of the Ramones, Evil Laugh, and Infinity Pool. Robert Muggy, man, heavy hitters right out of the gate. Robert Muggy writes, Triangle of Sadness, Designed for Living, Tootsie, 4 Days in July, Grown-Ups, and Manhunt. And in a conversation with Sam and Robert, that's always good. Eric writes, First Views, All Quiet on the Western Front, the latest one. La Chienne, Close-Up, Castaway, Causeway. Cornel Wilde's No Blade of Grass, which is as awful as they say, from 1970. And to Leslie, the rewatch was The Day After Trinity, excellent documentary about J. Robert Oppenheimer and the building of the A-bomb, which I first saw on PBS on or around the 40th anniversary of Hiroshima. Amanda writes The Menu and Chef, as well as Frozen 2 and A Man Called Otto. JJ writes, Missing, 2023, good diversion. Seven, and Hooper, still awesome. Cassie writes, Don't Worry, Darling. Pam writes, Tar and Till. Haley writes, The Menu and The Interview. Jed writes, Spent the last few evenings showing my oldest my favorite Three Stooges shorts, including my favorites, I'll Never Heil Again and Men in Black. All right. Terry writes, My Winnipeg and The Woman in the Window. Bonnie writes, Banshees of Inisherin, The Menu, The OG Buffy, The Original Vampire Slayer, Best On-Screen Vampire Death of All Time, she says. Jeff writes, Blonde. Daniel writes, Lady in Ermine, Star Quality, Tar, Wuthering Heights, Tickets to Paradise, Swing High, Swing Low, The Trouble with Spies, The Eternal Daughter, and The Diamond Horseshoe. Thank you, Daniel. Continuing on to the list here, Gary writes, Loved Banshees and Elvis. Tom writes, I took on a project. I watched every Daniel Craig James Bond film, Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, Spectre, and No Time to Die. A, interesting linear storytelling as we see the development of Bond and the people he loses in his life, a far cry from the Cubby Broccoli era, yeah. B, too many story and screenwriters as compared to the slick earlier work of Richard Maybaum. C, revenge killing is the theme to most of these movies. And D, Javier Bardem may be the best Bond villain area ever, despite the shaky origin story. More than you wanted to know. But you wrote it, Tom, so thank you. Gary writes, Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, the Riff Trax treatment. Battles Without Honor or Humanity. 2019 Aladdin, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, Haunters, 42nd Street Memories, Pinocchio. Which one, though, Gary? Because Guillermo del Toro's is in my top five, and Robert Zemeckis's is not. Blood Hunt and Blood Into Wine. Connor writes The Menu, Banshees of Inisherin, and Glass Onion. Kurt writes Year of Living Dangerously, Sigourney Weaver, Mel Gibson, while they were both rising stars and not quite complete aliens yet, as of different sorts. Thank you, Kurt. Adrian writes, Mickey and I loved women talking. Helen writes, Babylon. Lisa writes, Banshees of Inisherin and the series Wilder. Melissa writes, The Sweetest Thing. Jimmy writes, The Banshees is a horrible movie. He, of course, means Banshees of Inisherin. I asked, how so? The reply, what thinking violin player would cut off his fingers just to spite someone who would not stop talking to him? Well, that's Jimmy's answer. There's a little more to the film than that, and it's Martin McDonagh's work. If you've not read his work, go check out In Bruges and Three Billboards. It's just that operatic. So, yeah, there you go. Thank you. Thank you for chiming in, Jimmy. Catherine writes The Pale Blue Eyes, which she deemed oof, as well as Bullet Train. Anne writes Knives, Glass Onion, as well as A Man Called Uwe, the original. Jean writes Elvis, See How They Run, and The Man Who Invented Christmas. Jenny writes The Menu, The Proposal, We Bought a Zoo, and Spanglish. Sylvia writes The Menu, and finally, Kevin writes McFarlane USA, as well as Gleason. So there you go. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you've been able to watch some good movies that are new, as well as new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. All right, friends. We're going to dip into the archives. Earlier this week, Fresh Air had an interview with F. Murray Abraham talking about his work in The White Lotus and then his own career as a whole. And I got to interview Murray, as he lets me call him, back in 2009. This was one of the first legit interviews I got with Film Sociology. And F. Murray Abraham is a lovely man and a great storyteller of his work. So he was in town back in 2009. He was doing a little spoken word thing, being backed up by the ISO, which is not bad company to have. So, and if Fresh Air can dip into the archives, so can Film Sociology. Although this was a new interview with Murray, mine is old. It just seemed like for a while, Fresh Air, if it involved Mad Men, Breaking Bad, or The Wire, they would always replay stuff. And I do that here. And, you know, I try to play the Tommy Wiseau interview at least once a year. And some other greatest hits, but this is one that helped kind of put me on the Film Sociology map, my own map. Anyway, from 2009, here's my chat with F. Murray Abraham. Enjoy.
Well, what's on your mind?
Well, first off, I guess I should, how should I address you?
Your Majesty.
My liege, I was thinking, but.
My name is, I'm half Syrian, half Italian, and it's hard to please both sides of the family. So my father's name is Frederick, and my name is Frederick, but I decided to use an F because the Syrians call me Farid and the Italians call me Federico. So with the F, I pleased everybody.
All right, so F. Murray.
That's fine. Murray is just dandy.
Murray, okay.
And how do I call you?
Matthew.
Okay, Matthew.
And so obviously you played a lot of Wasp, obviously, with your background.
I played a lot of Wasp. Yeah, I don't think I ever played a Wasp in my life.
How did you get hooked up with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra?
I've been doing this for years, all over the world.
This particular piece?
And I think that this particular piece, you know what we're doing, right? The Copland piece?
Lincoln's Portrait.
Yeah, it's just, it's very meaningful to me. And the first time I ever did it was here in town with the New York Philharmonic. And I was carried away. I really was very moved by that, by those words. And I had done some studying. I had played a Lincoln once, believe it or not, speaking of Wasps.
A Continental?
A Continental Lincoln? No. Hey, you know, that was a great-looking car.
Yes, it was.
It was a wonderful car at one time.
Back when cars were a piece of art.
Well, yeah, you're talking to a car fiend. I agree with you. When you could, we could spot cars by the sound of their mufflers. They were that individual. I don't know if you know that.
I grew up in an automotive town up in Michigan, so yeah, I remember those days.
Where were you, around Flint?
Yes, I grew up in Flint. Got out with all my fingers.
Yeah, well, my people were steel workers in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
We made the steel that, I don't know, you have your own steel mills in Indiana, I know that.
Well, not really. Gary's a wasteland nowadays.
Well, have you been to Flint lately?
Yes.
I mean, it's really too bad. It's a depressing thing. A friend of mine who lives there, when I did a concert in Detroit, it was one of these concerts, only this was an interesting concept. A concert. It was, I'm trying to think, it was, you know Stravinsky's Story of a Soldier.
Yes.
Rather, his music for it.
Right.
Well, Vonnegut has written an adaptation. He said that the original story has nothing to do with reality. He said the music does. The discordant, the wonderful, driving, strange, and absolutely brilliantly original music. I worship Stravinsky. This is a tough piece of literature and writing. He hated war, Vonnegut did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's extraordinary. I don't know why it's not done more often instead of the original. But I was doing it in Michigan, and a friend of mine took me out for a ride out by the lake to have a nice fish dinner. And I saw all those beautiful mansions, all for sale.
Yeah. Now, how often do you get to do pieces like this with symphonies?
Well, it's whenever I get calls, and if I'm not making a flick, or if I'm not doing a play, I jump at the chance, because I don't know how to explain it. If you have a chance to be on the stage with an orchestra, you have to do it. You have to arrange it if you have any pull anywhere, just to be on the stage with them while they're working out.
Now, is this a piece where it's in between the songs, or they're playing under you as you're reading?
It's going to be between and during.
Ooh.
It's just thrilling.
That's got to be a rush.
Oh, I can't begin to tell you. And I've worked with some of the greatest in the world. And it's thrilling. I mean, really thrilling. It's like a different kind of a thrill, because there's it's not an intellectual activity. It's far beyond it's really deeply... It's visceral, but at the same time, it's transporting. It's transcending. Great.
Well, it's interesting, because when you do a film, unless the director pumps music onto the set during a shot, I mean, that's one thing. But to be able to have, I mean, you the soundtrack is behind you.
Yeah, the only problem with it, I mean, the danger, not the problem, is that if you miss your cue, you're in trouble, because the orchestra doesn't try to vamp and catch up. It's hard to do with 90 pieces.
It's,
you know?
It's not a jazz combo.
It's great. It's also a completion of sorts in terms of an actor, because there are things that an actor in the classical works, for example, any Shakespeare, any musical piece of work, Moliere, for example, or even some of the beautiful music that's in Tennessee Williams, you're never going to be able to achieve what music achieves. You try to,
mm-hmm.
Vocally and also spiritually, but you can't accomplish what Mozart does. It's just a different thing. But the idea that you can combine them, it's a kind of a gift, I must tell you. It's like a little present. And the whole thing is, I'm sure, because I did that movie so many years ago, Amadeus.
25.
I mean, can you imagine? That thing is still alive. People still love it.
Yes, I can, actually. I was 14 when that film came out. I remember being the youngest one in the theater by about 30 years. And not only did this film introduce me to and open my mind to classical music, but I went, wow, who is this guy? You know, the guy from Animal House is great, but who's him? Who is he? And that was, for a lot of people, that was the world introduction to F. Murray Abraham.
Yeah, it was a treat. It was a gift. The problem is, of course, it's not being able to do another one like it, you know?
No Amadeus 2, the final years.
Well, my son said that there should be a sequel where Amadeus is where Mozart's son grows up and wants revenge. He wants to call it Amadambo. Anyway,
don't give Michael Bay any ideas. Now, when you filmed that, did you do the young Salieri first or the old one first?
The old one. I did all the old stuff first. We did it in 3 weeks.
Wow. How much time on the chair for makeup?
4 hours, 4.5 hours each morning.
Were you able to sleep?
Well, I was pretty intense. I don't know how to tell you. I'm a pretty intense actor anyhow, but I was completely dedicated to that. And I lived alone when I was in Prague to be away from the company. It was all completely focused. I think the biggest mistake I made, if you can call it a mistake, is expecting to, from that point, do that kind of work for the rest of my life in film. That's kind of naive.
Well, what was the silliest script you got after winning the Oscar?
Oh, gee, there were so many that I refused. I should have done them just for the money, if not anything else. But they were just silly. They made me out to be a villain. I don't think Salieri is a villain. I think he's a real human being.
Well, Carl Malden said bad guys don't wake up thinking they're bad guys. They got a job to do.
That good old Carl Malden. I just saw One Eyed Jacks not long ago. He's so good in that.
Yeah, I just watched Baby Doll. Not a film to watch with your wife, but...
That's another good performance. Was that Kazan?
Yes. It's funny you mentioned intensity. My daughter, she's 7, and she said you were intense in Muppets from Space.
Isn't that great?
She's like, you're talking to him? I went, yes, that's part of Daddy's job,
oh,
believe it or not.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
That's so flattering. Isn't that a great age?
Yeah. She's. It's funny. My wife is an actress, and any role that my wife plays, my daughter wants to play. So she refers to herself as Baby Gertrude and Baby Parthy. And last year, Lynn got to do Lear, and Emma said, I'm Baby Goneril. And we went, no, you're not. No, no, no. That's wrong, and on so many levels. Yeah, don't give her any. I directed that, but she doesn't remember, thank God.
You're an actor.
I try. My wife is equity. I'm independent. And if it's a choice between my wife's guaranteed equity money and or my vanity projects, I let the missus work.
Works the work. So. I mean, you can see that for some of the films I've done. I mean, after a while, you think, well, I'm not going to wait anymore for a good film. I've got to make the rent.
Well, even
after a while, you think, oh, God, do I have to do this? And you do.
But I think even films that are, maybe there's not high-profile roles, but when I see you in something like Insurrection and Surviving the Game, I'm like, well, he's going to be fine. He knows what he's doing.
Well, I love the idea of people asking me, like, well, why are you doing those movies? Well, that's kind of a dumb question. I mean, you do what you have to do. But if they ask me to do other films, I would do them. But it seems to me that my life is really revolves around the theater here in New York, and I do films when I have a break from the theater,
as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah, but it's a nice life. Mm-hmm. Just one of those. I love Shakespeare, and you can't live on Shakespeare, not in New York anyway. I don't think you can anywhere. I mean, I don't think they pay very well.
Mm-hmm. Was it after Amadeus that you wound up doing a lot more classical theater?
Oh, yeah, I was doing it before, but afterwards it was amazing how it kind of guarantees your work life. It's hard to believe. I mean, I'm a good actor, but there are a lot of good actors around. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not selling myself short, but you know what I'm talking about. You got to have some luck in this business.
Sure.
And I've had some luck, but. Ever since I won the Academy Award, I've been working practically every day. It's just been wonderful stuff off-Broadway, experimental stuff with Richard Foreman and with Tom O'Horgan and, gosh, I guess everybody in town. I really had a great time.
You still do.
I'm going to continue having a great time.
Well, it seems like it's been, from an artist standpoint, to be able to do stage and screen and voiceover and narration, so you're not stuck in a rut. You're not stuck doing a soap or a sitcom for years and years and years.
Yeah, it's the best.
And one of the things that's always been was cool for me, especially after seeing Amadeus, was you were one of those guys. And when I saw your earlier work, I'm like, oh, my – I was a caffeinated 15-year-old. So I'm like, oh, it's the Amadeus dude. And – Scarface and Serpico and the Sunshine Boys. It was one of those, I have to go back, and this is before the internet, I'm like, I have to go back and find out what else this guy has done to lead up to this.
Oh, you got to take a look at the Ritz.
Yes, I saw the Ritz at too young of an age.
I should
revisit it again now that I'm more semi-mature.
Well, it works better on the stage, I think, but it's not a bad picture. Reed is great.
Yes. And I especially liked your work in Mighty Aphrodite.
Oh, thanks. That was fun.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you couldn't have seen any of my stage work, though, because I...
Well, you're still doing some stage work, right? I just need to go east.
I've been doing Ethan Coen's plays. Those are pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know anything about them.
What are some of the plays?
Well, he's written 6 plays, and I've been in 4 of them.
So you're one of the community players.
They're 6 one-acts, short pieces, and it seems like we've got a hookup, and it's great because they're funny and they're brief. And they're... What did Chekhov call his one-act plays? Vaudevilles? That's kind of what these are.
Right. now, did I see you just completed a picture of Barbarossa?
Yeah, it should be coming out next month.
This isn't a remake of the Gary Busey, Willie Nelson Western, right? This is completely different?
Gosh, I didn't know about that.
1982.
No, I don't know that picture. I know Gary. We worked together.
Mm-hmm.
In Surviving the Game.
Yes.
We really had a good time, he and I. I mean, you've heard stories about him, and I...
Yeah, we've seen him on TV, yeah.
I didn't see any of that stuff. I mean, we had a great time. We became quite close.
I mean, the guy doesn't get an Academy Award nomination for nothing.
That was a wonderful performance.
Yes. What is this Barbarossa about?
It's a historic character who actually tried to unify Italy, but under his command, Barbarossa came in from the north and tried to take it over. And it's this heroic story of a stand that these farmers made against this brilliant and great general, and these Italian farmers won. It's a historically in Italy. It was a great moment in their history.
And you shot it in Italy?
Yes, I do a lot of in Romania.
Oh.
In Italy. I do a lot of work with the Italians. I've been doing it for ever since before Amadeus, actually. It's kind of my second home.
And you got the...
this picture I'm doing now is part Italian. It's Italian and Canadian financed.
This one is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The one I'm working on. Oh. And Barbarossa was strictly Italian.
Oh, I see.
And that was the 5th film I made with that director. And I'm going to make another one with him next year in Italy and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
That, too, is a co-production between Canada and Italy. Don't ask me the connection. There it is.
It's all right. I remember going, my family and I went to Stratford, and there was the Canadian Chinese restaurant. Whatever it takes. What's the picture you're working on now?
This is Giancarlo Giannini, and I are old friends.
Ah.
He wrote this script for us, and he's starring in it and directing it as well, and we're shooting it just outside of Toronto. I'm in town for only about 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
I had a break and I came here to be with the family. But we're shooting up there, and then when we finish up in Toronto, we'll go back to Rome and finish up there.
I have
to be done with the picture on the end of October.
What's the title?
There's several titles. It feels a little like Woody Allen, the X Project.
Or untitled Woody Allen.
It's called Looking in Obituaries.
Yeah, it's going to be renamed in the States.
Script. He did well. He wrote it, too.
Cool.
Yeah, he's a good guy. He's an inventor, too, by the way. Anyway.
What did he invent?
He is an electronic genius.
Really?
He does inventions for his own house, for his own sound system. And it's a remarkable man. He really is, aside from being a remarkable ladies' man. They just fall over their feet when they see him. He's had a wonderful career. That his work with Lena was just sensational.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Lena Britt Mueller.
Yes.
I worked with her on a picture that she wrote.
What was the picture?
It was called, let's see, Enough About Romance, Now Let's Have Some Sausages. I mean, that's what she writes. But it was, my co-star was Sophia Loren.
Uh-huh.
And I played my wife, lover, and I got to kiss her a lot of times.
Wow. You wish Kubrick was directing that day.
Yeah.
Take 130.
I don't know if I understand Kubrick's last flick. I was very disappointed, and I'm a real big fan.
Eyes Wide Shut? I was with it until the third Last Warning.
I just thought this is becoming predictable and dull. And he's never dull.
No.
I mean, his early stuff is still great. The Killing is still
love. The
great
Killing, it's so funny when people. I show that to people, and I think they're used to the wide, huge, you know, almost bleak scope of something like The Shining in 2001. But Oh, The Killing is so good.
Yeah.
Great heist film. Now you got me thinking of Sterling Hayden, and I'm interviewing you.
Sterling Hayden, wow. Continues to churn it out, doesn't he?
Always timeless work. It was funny,
have you seen the... my wife discovered it recently. The original upon which, speaking of Sterling Hayden, Airplane was based?
Hit
the Zone, or what was it?
I thought there were a couple.
Zero Hour,
yes.
Have you seen it?
Not in a long time.
Oh, man, it's so funny.
So the Zuckers really were taking notes watching that.
No, they were lifting lines. The names are the same, too.
Oh, really?
At one point, didn't Sterling Hayden say, it's a fine time to quit smoking? That was his line originally. And he's very serious. I mean, of course, they're all very serious. But it's great. I mean, you got to see it.
I'll look for it because it was funny. That was 1980, and when the Airplane came out.
Oh, that couldn't have been that late,
really? No, Airplane. Yeah.
Oh, Airplane. Yeah.
Yeah, Airplane. But what I mean was, you had all these serious actors like Leslie Nielsen and Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack, and they were able to get a second wind of their careers doing that stuff.
Well, they were willing to make fun of themselves. I thought that was very bold, and also that the credit goes to the director for making them feel they can get away with it. I think that was they were wonderful. Bridges was sensational.
Yep.
But there was another line, the doctor on the plane. It was so legitimate. It was so funny.
I speak jive, no.
You have to find a doctor, but a doctor who didn't eat fish.
Oh, right.
It's an honest to God, anyway.
Hey, let's not forget about your tongue work in Loaded Weapon 1.
That could have been better. Anyway, that's always fun.
A few months ago, I actually found on DVD and bought and watched again Name of the Rose.
Ah, yeah.
Very scary in that, you are.
6 months shooting. Sean was terrific.
And that was your first of two times working with Sean.
Yeah, he's a good guy. At least he was with me, anyway.
That's good.
Yeah, we got along very well. I usually have trouble with anyone, but, you know, you can't get along with everyone.
Mm-mm.
Some people are impossible, and we won't even go into who they are. Okay?
I would never ask that. That's not this type. This is not that type of program. Okay. Just one film fan to another. I just
don't understand why we can't make better films. I really don't. I mean, we've got all these examples for the last, I don't know how many years now. There's no excuse for this crap. You know, there really isn't. There's just no respect for the word, I think, and that's what the problem is. Enough of this slice-of-life action crap. Let's get some art back into it. You know, those wonderful moments when you hear a theme or you see even a few frames of a picture, and you go, I want to watch this again. I can't wait to see this movie again. That's the kind of movie that we can still make. I mean, the idea that you have to spend $200 million for a picture and you still can't make anything but trash, it's absurd.
Do you get a lot of offers from, say, independent directors?
Well, I get them. It's just that even that, they're not very good. I'd love to work for Del Toro, for example.
Ooh.
He and I got along very well on Mimic. And we made promises, and I'm from the border of Mexico, and we both speak Spanish, and I just haven't heard from him. So I'm sure when something comes up, he'll call me, because he's a sincere man. But I think he's terrific, and he started out as an independent. What was that wonderful story from Buñuel when he was approached? Do you remember that picture that Woody Allen made where they're standing in line, and he talks, they're having an argument?
Annie Hall.
And Marshall McLuhan.
Marshall McLuhan is back behind the plant. If life were only like this.
Yes. Well, he originally wanted Buñuel to do that.
Oh, really?
And it was going to be a different conversation, but it was going to. And he offered. You know, he offers everyone the same money, take it or leave it. But for Buñuel, who said, "I can't do it. I'm busy. I'm working." And he said, "Well, I'll give you such and such amount of money." And he went up to $30,000, and which is outrageous for Woody Allen to offer.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a wealth of money for him to offer. And Buñuel still said, I really can't do it. And then he reflected and said, that was more money than my last film cost me to make, $30,000. Well, he was shooting in Mexico at the time. But
sure.
The point is, it doesn't have to be an expensive film to be a good one. You need a script. You need some good actors. And if you got a good script, you're going to get the actors.
Mm-hmm.
You get me just in a second. But anyhow, you do work for free. I mean, my theater work is practically, I have to underwrite it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Theater doesn't pay.
Oh, we know about underwriting here. This interview,
you know very well what I'm talking about.
This interview is made possible by memberships like yours. Thank you.
Love. I got no complaints. But I really think that, as I said before, I've got a lot of friends in this business, long-lived friends who are just brilliant actors with all these chops, and they can't get arrested. I have to keep reminding them and myself what luck means in our lives. And I'm a very proud actor. I love my profession, but I'm also full of humility. I'm constantly grateful for these breaks I've been getting. And I'm absolutely sincere when I tell you that.
Well, I looking back at even the film work, there doesn't seem to be anything that is embarrassing. And I've seen people with lots of money and lots of acclaim, and they do something that's just... it's just downright silly and not in a complimentary way. And that I don't think it's ever happened with you.
Keep talking. Listen, you're very nice. Thank you so much for this.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Thanks always to F. Murray Abraham for making the show a real show, as did Elmore Leonard, and I'll explain that one later. But, so anyway, go see some Oscar contenders, and we'll chat next week. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
No. We'll do it live!